Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.
This is True Crime Cast. Jamie here with John. Still, believe it or not, snowed in. So I drive to John's house. I know we're neighbors, but I drive over here.
Which wouldn't be possible if you didn't have four-wheel drive.
Today was the most treacherous out of the last 2 weeks, and it's snowing huge snowflakes right now.
What part was treacherous? Coming, like, going down your hill or getting in my driveway?
Both. It was bad. Everything's frozen over still. Kentucky is an iceberg.
Literally a emergency has been declared. Large cities like Lexington can't even get their roads plowed. And we are wrapping up 2 weeks of this, going into week three.
No school, events canceled. It's been a nightmare, but you know what it's been a great time to sit back, relax, and listen to some podcasts.
I have been listening to a lot, actually, and it's been really nice.
I have too. I've got some conspiracies we'll get to. I'm just kidding.
Okay, well, I've also been messaging my cousin who's in the Space Force. He was not able to give any kind of comments, but I feel like we've had a good conversation.
Okay, you got to
one
share
in
that.
Which he says that I'm a conspiracy theorist job and I need to move on with my life, basically, is the gist of that conversation.
Yeah, we go into that pretty in depth on Bless Their Hearts this Thursday, but that's not why you're here. You are here for an absolutely wild crime story.
This is one that I used to say this all the time, like, I cannot believe I'd never heard of this, but you presented this to me. I started researching it and I was like floored that I'd never heard of it.
I think the ending is why we've never heard of it. Just the way it ends, not in a big public way. And we'll get to that in a minute, but man, it's a lot.
We're about done with housekeeping, but before I do say that we're wrapped up, I do want to say thank you to Sherry and Fran. Both Sherry and Fran joined us over on Patreon in the last week. So, guys, thank you so much. That's a big help. And anyone who joins Patreon will instantly get access to nearly 8 years worth of exclusive monthly content and all of our episodes early and ad-free.
Absolutely. We appreciate those guys so much. And if you'd be interested, give it a shot for 1 month. If it's not worth it, go back. No harm done.
You're going to lose $3, worst case scenario.
Yeah, that's
less than a cup of coffee, and that price has not changed in 8 years.
I was going to say it was a cup of coffee when we started. Now it's half a cup of coffee.
Yeah, yeah. Things have got crazy, except not our prices.
Speaking of crazy, why don't you get us rolling on this case? The case is crazy, not you necessarily.
Do you want me to just kind of set up what we're going to be talking about? So we are going to give you a case where, man, it's a case that has a definitely clear victim, but not necessarily the most clear ending, but I would say it's completely resolved, if that makes any sense, and it will later. So the story is about a man named Nathan Carman, and he sits in a kind of a gray area of, did he do it? Did he not? We're going to get into all that, but this case involves the two deaths of people that are in the same family, but years apart. And they have just absolutely enormous financial means that I think is the motive of this story. So do you want me to keep going or do you want to start with some details on this case?
Yeah, let's save that last part for a little bit. At the center of the story is Nathan Carman, a man whose name is synonymous with mystery in the midst of all of this. Investigators eventually accused him of murder, but you have to go back. His mom disappeared at sea in 2016, which I mean, do people still disappear at sea? I know we've talked about individuals that have gone missing from cruises, but this sounds like a pirate situation.
Well, when you really get into the nuts and bolts of what he was doing around the same time as this, it definitely looks shadier. So I'm going to say, yes, people still disappear. Some people vanish on purpose.
They were a really wealthy family up in New England, but there was a lot of tension in their relationship with his mom because of an unresolved homicide that kind of hung over the family. So, yeah, there's a lot going on with this family leading up to that disappearance at sea. Take us back to the beginning.
Let's start in 1994. That's when Nathan Carman was born. He was born and raised in New England. And his family connections tied him to significant wealth. And most of that, if not all of it, came through his maternal grandfather, John Chakalos. I don't know if that's how you actually pronounce it. That's my best shot.
I mean, it sounds good. Just go with it.
So John was a very successful real estate developer in Connecticut. John had built a very sizable fortune. He lived a very comfortable life, mostly private and in a suburban neighborhood. Family members later described him as somewhat controlling, guarded, deeply distrustful, particularly when it came to money. And that distrust would later become a very critical element in how investigators viewed the events surrounding his death.
People just get so, they lose their minds around money. And
I'm almost thankful that my family doesn't have a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because yeah. I don't want to, like, if my mom was very wealthy, would I love an inheritance? Sure. Do I want to, like, just sit there and wait on her to die and then potentially have fights with my siblings? No, I would not.
You can find reasons to fight with them now.
Exactly.
It's like they always say, John, more money, more problems.
That's right.
Nathan's relationship with his mom, whose name is Linda, was complicated as well. Linda had divorced Nathan's dad when Nathan was really young, and multiple relatives later described their relationship as volatile, which is not a good descriptor of a mother-son relationship. Nathan struggled socially from an early age. He was diagnosed with Asperger's, which is considered part of the autism spectrum. I don't even know if people say Asperger's anymore, but it's very high-functioning autism.
Yeah, I don't even think that it's a part of the DSM-4 anymore. I think it's just considered on the spectrum of autism.
See, you question your intelligence and you drop a DSM reference. That's great. Family members said that due to his autism, we'll just go with that, it affected his ability to communicate, form relationships, and manage conflict. Some relatives described him as withdrawn, rigid, and others said that he was just kind of misunderstood, but they did agree that he kept to himself, wasn't very social, wasn't really engaged with the family members.
And oh my God, I think I might have it.
That's a great point. Those, I've been meaning to talk to you about this. To be clear, I have a child with autism, so this is very much speaking to me, and I can see this these behaviors in her for sure. But the different perceptions of his family members makes this even more complex once the tragedies start to happen, especially from the public's point of view.
Nathan's relationship with his grandfather was also kind of tense. There were court records and family testimony in which suggested that John distrusted Nathan deeply. John reportedly believed that Nathan was capable of violence and was so concerned about this that he actually changed his will. Instead of leaving money directly to Nathan, John placed his inheritance in a trust, and this would later fuel speculation and motive. I'm going to say maybe he did distrust Nathan. I don't know. But when you were talking about like upwards of $50 million. So it's fairly normal to just leave that in a trust.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't want to name a person who's a minor to get this money. So a trust will just set it up to where it's available when they reach a certain age or there's other stipulations. So I don't know that I can sit here and say that he definitely distrusted him because of a trust, but maybe the family knew more than we do. And there was a particular reason he wanted it in a trust.
I think the fact that he changed his will from an inheritance to a trust is what raised all the red flags. You mentioned it being $50 million. I'm going to leave my children fifties of dollars. And we have that all outlined. And it's a process to go back and change your will and testament. So the fact that he changed it, I think, is more telling than the fact that it was a trust.
We have a trust for our kids. Now, there's not anywhere close to even $1 million in it or $50 in it.
At least that's what we're telling them, right?
But you're right. It would be a pain in the butt to go back and meet with an attorney and just to them, the expense wouldn't be a problem, but the time. I mean, it takes time to go through all that process.
Absolutely. Investigators would argue that Nathan, because of this, even the trust, did gain financially if there were other members of the family out of the picture. And of course, for any of this money to change hands, they would have to wait till John Chakalos died.
And John was, I mean, he was over 80 years old. So you just be patient, and then it's going to roll in eventually.
They ran out of patience, though.
On October 20th, 2013, to be precise, John was found shot to death inside his home. He was laying in bed and had been killed with gunshot wounds to the head. There were two shots to the head, and one hit him in the abdomen. And when police got there, they were alerted to the fact that something was wrong because John had a pretty strict routine. He was up early, wandering around. He would make his phone calls, do his thing. And when that hadn't happened and no one was able to get in touch with him, they decided to call police, and they found this, you know, this poor man had been murdered at over the age of 80. It's insane. Because of his wealth, they assumed this was going to be like a burglary gone wrong. But when they got there, there were no signs of forced entry. There was no weapon at the scene. There were, like, I'm not going to say there were piles of cash, but there was cash in the home that wasn't secured. It was there. If someone was there to rob this guy, they would have taken the money that was there. So this seemed very personable. Personal?
Yeah. And the fact that there was no forced entry, I think, was huge. I mean, this was a guy who had means. He had good security. He was really paranoid about the security of his home. So the fact that nobody forced their way in, no broken windows, no door broken down, no locks picked, was a big point of suspicion for authorities. Investigators learned that Nathan had access to firearms and had been practicing shooting with his grandfather in the past. Nathan was never charged in this case, but law enforcement later confirmed that he was considered the top person of interest for who may have killed his grandfather.
They interviewed him, and they asked him if he had means to access a firearm, and he said that he had an air rifle, but obviously this was not an air rifle right. that murdered his grandfather. They found out it was a SIG, Salyer rifle. But yeah, I mean, ultimately it went cold. They yeah. thought it might've been him. They couldn't prove it. So that's it.
And you know, they couldn't prove it. I think public perception maintained that he was potentially responsible. And maybe more importantly, inside the family, people believe that he may have had something to do with it.
I think when, I mean, I don't know, like if my mother had $50 million and she was found murdered, I feel like all the siblings would be in the scene on The Office where they're just pointing at each other. Like, it was you. No, it wasn't. It was you.
Isn't that kind of the first Glass Onion movie or Knives Out movie?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. They didn't have any forensic evidence tying him to this. So it really, you could not go to court and prove anything. So this just went cold with no charges ever being filed in his death.
But of course, after the murder, Nathan's family entered more turmoil. When we get back from the break, we'll talk about Nathan's isolation and the other tragedies that happened to the Carman family.
After his grandfather's death, Nathan became more and more isolated. He struggled to maintain any kind of steady employment. He often had to live with his mother, Linda. Family members described Nathan as financially dependent and socially withdrawn. So basically, we've got a grown man mooching off his mama because he just isn't able to make it on his own.
I mean, he's in his early 20s, and this is in the 20 teens. I mean, that's becoming more and more common at that time for especially young men to stay home and live with family, and it takes longer to get that career started. So he was certainly, he had that social piece that was awkward, but his situation
is not unique,
on its own was not wild, but their relationship was very tense. So, of course, it adds to it.
And I don't think there's anything wrong. Like, if you do struggle with, and you have, you know, you're on the one end of the autism spectrum, people just, sometimes they just don't understand that. So finding a stable employment could be challenging. So maybe it's a good thing that Linda's there to support him. So prosecutors would later argue that Nathan felt trapped. He was cut off from the wealth that he believed should have been his. And he was just kind of living under the rule and thumb of his mom.
And remember, that trust went into effect, and he's in his 20s, and he can't touch that money because he's not in charge of the trust. But a few other people die, it works his way down to him.
So he wasn't, I guess I'm wondering, like, I would imagine the way it was set up to where John died, that money is left in a trust to his children.
Right.
And then once those people pass, then the trust would be in effect for their children.
Right.
So it doesn't just be, it's not split up between his children and Grand's children. It goes directly to his children.
Right. So they have to go away in order for him to have access. And that's one of the, I mean, that's the main motive that people believe. Linda did support him both financially and emotionally. She tried to be there for him. She knew that he had a hard time socially and making ends meet. So she wanted to try to set him up for success. But during this time, she was also telling her relatives that she was starting to get scared of Nathan. She was worried that he could be violent, that he had so much animosity toward her for whatever reason that she felt unsafe. Some family members claim that Linda worried that he may do something to end her life in an effort to get to the money. Other people in the family disputed this, saying that Linda was just a worrier. She was trying to help her son, but at the same time, she just was so afraid that something was going to go wrong, and there was so much tension already in the family. So, again, conflicting accounts about Nathan before his grandfather's death, and more conflicting accounts afterwards. So who is he for real? I assume he's somewhere in the middle, but this became a central part to the case.
By 2016, he had acquired a boat. And on September 17th, 2016, he wanted to take his mama out on a fishing trip off the coast of Rhode Island. So this boat was not like a yacht. This was a, I mean, it's a nice boat. It's a small fishing vessel that he had acquired. And according to Nathan, the trip was meant to be a bonding experience between he and his mom. Weather conditions the day that they went out were reported to be relatively calm. But what happened next became a defining event in this overall story. Sometime after leaving the shore, the boat began taking on water. Nathan later claimed that the vessel began sinking rapidly, forcing him and his mom to have to retreat into the ocean. And he said that when they did that, he ended up losing sight of Linda in the water and was just unable to save her. Now, I think it was like 11 days later, Nathan was rescued by himself by the U.S. Coast Guard. He was in a life raft. Linda's body had never been recovered.
Which is wild, right? Like, there, I would love to have more history on his boating, on his boating, as your kids call it when we go boating. But we don't know, was he really good at handling this vessel? Was this something he did often? Had his mom gone out with him before? Regardless, it was a disaster. The boat did sink, but was his story of what happened, did it line up with the evidence and the truth? And investigators were skeptical early on because this is the second family death that Nathan's been very close to. The Coast Guard searched, but they were not able to find any wreckage consistent with a sudden sinking. Normally, if something went under due to taking on water and it wasn't planned, you would be able to locate it fairly easily. Experts would later question whether the boat could have sunk the way that Nathan described at all. Was it even possible? Again, going back to his diagnosis, he may have trouble explaining things in a way that makes sense to other people. He sees the world in a very different way. Like, the term neurodivergent is very clear in that now. This common term used for individuals like Nathan. So maybe it was just a communication issue. Investigators would eventually uncover evidence suggesting that the boat had been modified. Those modifications would become one of the biggest red flags in this case. Thinking about the story back to Scott Peterson, he didn't modify his boat, but supposedly made all those concrete anchors. There are lots of modifications you can make to a boat, changing motors. You can change, if you're going out to sea, you can change the fins on the bottom. You can change fuel injection systems. So modifications is a very wide range, but what he modified You know, that, for whatever reason, raised red flags.
Well, he tried to file an insurance claim 2 weeks after he was rescued. It was $85,000 that he was seeking in insurance. And they rejected the claim, saying that his work that he did, the modifications, that whether they directly or indirectly caused the boat to repair, those were the things that, happened to lead to this loss of a vessel.
They voided the warranty, pretty much, yeah. Or the insurance.
Now, I don't understand what he did, but there was a someone at the dock the morning that he left, and they said that he was drilling holes, and it wasn't, the way I understand it, he wasn't drilling holes like to the bottom of the boat where it's going to immediately
super sink. Obvious.
But you are a boat owner. I don't know if you've ever heard of this. There's some kind of stabilizer that's on a boat, and basically he removed the stabilizers.
Okay.
And the gentleman that saw him doing this was a boat repairman, and he told Nathan, according to his statement, "Hey, you shouldn't do that. That's going to make it unsafe. Like you could definitely like tip over if you take those off, because they're in the ocean." So, I mean, do you know what stabilizer, does your boat have anything like that? Or have you heard of that?
Yeah. So I think it could be a number of different pieces, but basically it allows you to adjust your speed and your, and kind of get the angle so that you're not just like nose up flying. So it allows you to level out and kind of go across the top of the water instead of going up or going like against the grain into the water.
I gotcha. So if you're going really fast, nose up would be helpful.
It could be.
You wouldn't want to go really, really fast and then all of a sudden go nose, like a nosedive.
Right. Most of the time you want to be pretty flat, because if your nose is up, especially in the ocean, you hit a wave, that's that could be dangerous, especially with people if they're not secured on board. But
regardless,
you don't want to be going down.
Removing this on open ocean water, this guy was saying, this is not going to lead to good things. This is going to make it a very dangerous trip.
Right. Especially if you're, depending on how far you go out and the speeds, it's questionable, I think, at best. As the search for Linda continued, they continued to hone in on Nathan. Some people saw him as the survivor of this tragic accident. He persevered for 11 days out on the sea, but other people were like, hey, his family members keep dying while he's around.
Also, interesting location where they found him, right? They were expecting him to be 30 miles away from his last cell phone ping towards the west, I believe. And that's where they tried to coordinate all their search efforts there, because they ran all of these models showing the ocean currents, and that's where all these models pointed to.
Right.
When he's finally picked up by Coast Guard, number one, they say that he does not look like a man who had been in the ocean surviving and doing his best for 11 days, because he looks like he just got off of a cruise ship rather than a shipwreck. And he was also 30 miles in the opposite direction of where ocean currents would have taken him.
And to be clear, the way to do that would be to simply turn your cell phone off, drive the opposite direction. If you need to discard something from the vessel, a body, you do that. Then you sink it and magically show up in your Sunday best on a raft.
Coincidentally, and I'm sure it's just a coincidence, but he did buy an anchor and a lot of rope, but the anchor was way too small for his vessel. So I'm sure he had some other purpose for that.
Yeah. And I mean, the prosecutors argued that what he was doing was not random maintenance, but he was trying to make his boat deliberately vulnerable to taking on water in hopes of potentially staging an accident that would look like the boat sank. And they found some key structural components of the boat that have been removed. Like you mentioned, there's buoyancy foam that helps the vessel stay afloat, and that appeared to be gone. I mean, the boat's not necessarily just a piece of metal, right? It's very, there are lots of redundancies to make sure that it doesn't sink, let alone quickly. And I mean, there was no wreckage. There was no debris. It didn't look like other parts of the... It's not like he was in a life raft and there's like a sail over here and a cooler over there. He was just chilling by himself. So where was everything else?
Nathan maintained his innocence the whole time. He insisted the trip was recreational and that the sinking was sudden and terrifying. He described being helpless in the water. He was unable to look for his mother. And supporters pointed out that surviving alone at sea for hours, or days, let alone just a few hours, that was going to be a traumatic event for him. They argued that Nathan's behavior afterward was reflective of shock and trauma and not guilt.
And I get that. Anytime we listen to a 911 call, it is pretty impossible to judge somebody's reaction. You're not in their circumstances. Some people do go into shock and kind of shut down. Some people lash out emotionally. It's hard to judge somebody's reaction to a traumatic experience. So if they felt like he was acting guilty, he was already, socially awkward. So it's a very complicated situation, and it continued to complicate itself after Linda's disappearance. Investigators noted inconsistencies from his statements about the trip. One time they would be further out than he described before they started taking on water. One time he would have almost saved his mom and wasn't able to. So there were a lot of different pieces that he just continued to change his story about, which is always, again, a red flag. And they became a central part of what the government would ultimately bring in a case against him. But again, trauma, stress, neurodivergent, he's already got a lot going on.
There was a lot of public reaction to Nathan Carman, and it was divided. Some people saw him as an emotionally flat and very detached man. Others who were more familiar with autism spectrum disorders cautioned against interpreting his behavior as any kind of guilt. Nathan's Asperger's diagnosis, or autism now, complicated how the public and investigators assessed his demeanor. So this was, this is very tenseful, because you could look at him, and if you're not familiar with Asperger's autism, yeah, he's not going to appear as if he is a quote unquote normal. That's a terrible way to say that.
Yeah. I mean, but it's
he's different. Misunderstood.
Yeah.
He's misunderstood because it brings on different personality characteristics.
It does. And it makes engagement, it makes showing emotions harder. It's harder for them sometimes to be empathetic. So there are a lot of things, unexpected behaviors, I think, is a great way just to put how he lives his life, let alone after all this trauma. And due to Linda's disappearance, investigators said, you know what? Let's go back and take another look at Grandpa John and what happened to him just a few years ago. Again, no charges have ever been filed there, but prosecutors would later argue that these two cases shared some troubling similarities, one of which, of course, was the commonality of being in the same family, connected to the same line of money, and both left behind unanswered questions that prosecutors said they couldn't ignore anymore. They got to figure out what's going on here.
Family members remained deeply divided as well. Some members in the family believed he was a dangerous individual. These internal fractures would later spill into public view as the federal case against him developed. So the Carman family story became less about one incident and really became more of like a long simmering family tragedy case.
Yeah, this is more than just looking at the evidence with the boat, with the relationship between Nathan and Linda, more than just what happened at John's house and the way he was shot. Like, you've got to look at the whole picture. Fast forward to 2022, which is almost 6 years after Linda disappeared and almost 9 years since John was killed. Prosecutors made a move. They arrested Nathan Carman, and he was indicted on charges of murder on the high seas and related fraud offenses. I wonder if murder on the high seas is its own individual charge.
It needs to be.
Federal jurisdiction applied because it was technically in international waters. So they could.
I was wondering if it was actually a charge because it was on international waters. So it may very well be the case.
Yeah, I think it is. Prosecutors argued that Nathan deliberately killed his mother, disposed of her body in the ocean, and orchestrated the incident to look like an accident. So they were focusing mainly on Linda's circumstances here because they thought he surely had something to do with it.
Well, the indictment laid out a sweeping theory. Prosecutors claim Nathan sabotaged the boat, planned the fishing trip, and knowingly placed his mother in danger. All of that combined equals premeditation.
Right.
Also alleged he intended to collect insurance money and the inheritance. Now, the insurance money was ultimately denied, but the inheritance money was going to be set to come his way. Importantly, prosecutors emphasized that they did not need to recover Linda's body to prove murder. Circumstantial evidence, they argued, told the complete story.
I mean, Taylor Swift's got a song, No Body, No Crime. That's not necessarily the case, Taylor. There are lots of charges that have been placed and convictions that have been made without a body. So, common misconception for Swifties out there, but you can prosecute without a body. And I think that's appropriate here. I don't think you need to have her body. Of course, Nathan pleaded not guilty. His defense team maintained that there was no evidence of any kind of intention to kill his mother, no evidence that he did anything to her out on the open sea, or even that he had ill intentions of crashing the boat and trying to survive himself. They argued that the government's case relied heavily on speculation and hindsight. The absence of a body, the absence of a weapon, no eyewitnesses was central to their case. How could they convict somebody with zero evidence that he actually did anything to this person? So we've talked a lot about division in this case. The public was divided about Nathan's reactions. The family was divided about Nathan's personality and whether or not he had a tendency to be violent. And this trial just further drew people apart.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, no physical evidence, a lot, in my opinion, of circumstantial evidence, but would it be enough? Well, we'll never know, Jamie, because before this case could ever go to trial, the story took another tragic turn. Nearly 7 years after Linda's disappearance and almost a year after he was arrested on federal charges, Nathan Carman died while awaiting trial, and he was in federal custody when that happened. On the morning of June 15th, 2023, Carman was found unresponsive in his jail cell in the Cheshire County Department of Corrections in Keene, New Hampshire, where he had been held without bail while awaiting trial on the murder and related fraud charges. Jail personnel discovered Carman in his cell during routine overnight rounds. He was alone when he was found, and officials later confirmed that he showed no outward signs of foul play. Corrections staff attempted to resuscitate him, but he was later pronounced dead after emergency responders had arrived.
In the immediate aftermath, authorities stressed that his death was not being treated as suspicious. They're saying that there's no evidence that somebody else harmed Nathan or that he took his own life. Statements from the New Hampshire Attorney General's office and the autopsy performed by the state's medical examiner confirmed that there was no evidence of any type of altercation or any type of trauma, and that his death was not being treated as suspicious in nature.
Sources close to the investigation later told media outlets that Carman's death was likely a suicide. There was at least one of his attorneys that had said that he did indeed leave a note in his cell that was addressed to his legal team, and that perhaps that could shed light on his state of mind or his intentions. Officials have confirmed the family, his attorneys, and investigators have been notified of the cause of and manner of death, but those detailed findings from the autopsy report have not been publicly released.
So the fact that Nathan Carman died before this trial meant that federal murder on the high seas charges could not go forward, effectively ending the criminal case without a resolution in court. In legal terms, when a defendant dies while charges are pending, those charges are dismissed, which leaves a permanent legal ambiguity. No verdict on guilt, no vindication of innocence, no jury of your peers to make that decision. It's left completely open-ended. For the families involved, that legal reality has created its own kind of problems, a gap between suspicion, prosecution, and closure that the justice system isn't able to fully put back together for this family. So who killed John? What happened to Linda? I don't think we're ever going to get to know the truth now.
Carman was only 29 years old at the time of his death. His legal team said that they had been preparing for the trial. It was going to be scheduled later in 2023. And his attorney said they repeatedly told outlets that they were looking forward to the opportunity to prove his innocence in trial. But instead, his life ended tragically behind bars under circumstances that the authorities describe as non-suspicious. But this is still deeply tragic for everyone connected to the case. The family had been through it, man. Whether or not that was at the hands of John, we'll never know. But there's three people in this family that are gone that we can never get back.
These family deaths have become a matter of media coverage across the board. Documentaries, long-form reporting introduced this case to a global audience. You asked about why we hadn't heard about it. I think it's because there was no trial and there was no verdict, or this would have been a much bigger deal. Online communities dissected every detail, from the mechanics of the boat to the family psychology, and you can find a Reddit thread to support your theory on whether Nathan was a victim, a villain, or somewhere in between. So, John, I'm going to ask you, I guess let's start back at the beginning. Do we think that Nathan killed John and or Linda?
Man, I don't know. I mean, for John's, there was never a murder weapon found. Am I mistaken in that?
You're right.
So with that not being found, I don't know that it has. They did say that it was a SIG. So that's a kind of, SIG makes a bunch of different kinds of guns, but they said specifically it was a SIG rifle. They, as far as I know, John didn't have one of those. I don't know if he had access to one of those. We don't have the murder weapon. We don't have fingerprints from a murder weapon. I'm not going to say that I believe in my heart 100% he was responsible. As far as Linda, why did he remove those things from the boat? Was it a careless mistake that he thought there's too much weight on this boat, we need to take some of these unnecessary things off? Or was it intentional? I don't know. It's very odd. He was informed by someone, allegedly, the morning of, that he should not take those things off. He bought an anchor that was undersized for the boat. We don't know where it's at. His mom's disappearance seems a lot more confirming in my mind than his grandfather John's. Jamie, I don't know. If there is someone nefarious in the family, is Nathan just the easy person to be the scapegoat? I don't know.
As far as we know, there wasn't another family member that was pointed at as directly as Nathan was. I certainly don't think there would be enough evidence as we have it now to convict him of John's murder.
There are conflicting reports, because there was a family member back before John died that said, if he messes with my inheritance, I'll blow his brains out. And then
that happened.
Guess what? His brains were blew out. So there, I've read some sources that say that did happen. I've read some that it's questionable. So I don't know.
I think it's more likely than not he had something to do with Linda's disappearance. I do think she's dead. I think it's more likely than not, but I don't know if it's beyond a reasonable doubt, which is what we would have found out in trial. I do think he took his own life in prison. That's kind of why it's been so kept close to the vest there, that the family knows what happened. It's never been publicly released. I think he took his own life, and with Nathan went the truth of whether or not he was involved with these things. He was very antisocial. I'm sure that a lot of things got pointed his way due to his autism, which is extremely unfortunate. I hope we're doing a better job now of educating people about differences in the way people behave based on their neurology, if you will. So I think just so many questions, and it makes it fascinating. Of course, his autism makes it more complex, but at this point, I don't think we're going to get any more answers unless somebody else did it and they find a way to prove it.
I think you're right. And Lord, it's scary. Like, if John did die because of Nathan, and you know, Linda died because of Nathan as well, then federal prosecutors had it right. But we'll never know for sure if what he would have been found, you know, would he been found innocent or guilty. It's awful, but I think you're right. I don't know that we're ever going to figure this one out.
There is a documentary on Netflix called The Carman Family Deaths, if you want to go check that out and get some interviews with local officials and other family members. But such a fascinating story. Three tragic deaths. Were they related or were they not? How much do you believe in coincidence? This is one that I think I can't give a strong opinion on. I think everybody's going to have their own opinion, and we would love to hear yours.
Yeah, that's for sure. If you have an opinion, please leave it on social media. We'd love that. You can also leave it in the form of a 5-star rating or review.
Yeah, we greatly appreciate that. We can read that on the air when those come in.
Guys, we love you and we appreciate you. Until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.
You've listened to True Crime Cast, distributed by Stoveleg Media. Check out Stoveleg.com to find out more about your hosts and to find other podcasts to listen to. Stoveleg Media, igniting conversation.